You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 20th to the 26th of November 2014. My name's Chris Parr, I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, reporter Holly Else, deputy features editor Paul Jump and books editor Karen Shook. Our news section this week is dominated by grant application success rates, which have fallen for the first time in 5 years. Also set to fall is the research budget, as the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills prepares for the next spending review period. Karen will be here to give us the lowdown on this week's book section, which thankfully hasn't been cut, and is, as ever, full to the brim. And our cover feature this week is all about academic novels. Five scholars reflect on representations of academia in literature, and Paul will tell us a little more about that very soon. But first, grant application success rates. It's always a big story for us. Holly, you've got the story this week. For the uninformed, what do these statistics show us?
Well, they show us that for the first time in 5 years, there's been a decline in people's researchers' success when applying for grant funding from the research councils. Mm. It's only a small decline, so 2 percentage points, and it takes the means the success rate is now at the rate it was about 2 years ago. The people that we spoke to suggested this could largely be due to a decline in the amount of money that the research councils actually gave out this year, mm-hmm. and the fact that the research budget is a flat cash settlement, but the cost of research has increased in that time. So basically they are funding fewer applications. Now one research council did actually buck that trend. The mm-hmm. Arts and Humanities Research Council had a slight increase in its success rate, and they put that down to the fact that they had more money available this year than last year. And then some people might start to question whether the fall in success rates is because demand management techniques are sort of maybe losing their effectiveness. But I think the analysis that we've done shows that that's not the case, because applications are continuing to decline. So there are the processes designed to weed out the weaker applications, I think, are still probably having an effect.
As well as that sort of decline in success, we do highlight the most successful institutions. Paul, your name on this story. The top 10 institutions by income this year, Imperial tops the tree.
Yeah, that's right. We should probably say that it was stated that the overall success rate this year was 28%, so it was, which is down from 30 the previous year, but it's still, you know, relatively healthy. The research councils only tend to get jumpy when they go below 20, so they're probably not panicking at this point. But yeah, in terms of institutions, yeah, Imperial, well, for four of the last 5 years it has been on top of the pile. Last year it wasn't. It was beaten off the top by UCL, but yeah, it's back this year, 114 million mm-hmm. it won in 1 year. And you know, they're one of the few institutions whose incomes from the research councils actually went up this year. So they sort of bucked their trend, because overall the research councils are giving out considerably less mm-hmm. this year. So consequently, most institutions have got less money this year. Imperial is one of the views that went up, yeah.
Indeed. Well, that full top 10, we won't give it away here, because we want you to go along to our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk, where you'll find the full top 10. Holly's been crunching the numbers all week. There's several really useful sort of charts, tables there to give you the full picture. Simon, it's a lively time politically at the moment. We're recording this on the day of the Student March for Free Education through London. We've got news this week about how HE might be affected, however, by the next spending review period.
Well, there's a general election coming up, and so we don't know who the next government will be after May. Civil servants are already being told to sort of model various different scenarios in terms of cuts for the next spending review. Because at the moment, government sort of spending is only set up until the end of the 15-16 financial year. So that's mm-hmm. up to April 2016, basically. And after that, they're going to have to think about setting budgets again. And obviously, the only kind of figures that have really been talked about in terms of what funding there'll be is that the Conservatives have already said that they want to cut overall government spending by a figure that's been bandied around was 25 billion, mm-hmm. As well as kind of there being tax cuts. And there's lots of debate about that. So, you know, we certainly know roughly where the Conservatives might stand if they won the next election. But because there's so little time between the end, you know, the general election, and then there'll probably be a spending review last time around. It was within a few months of the general election. The civil servants have been asked to kind of think the unthinkable and come up with whatever scenarios there could be finding this money in different departments. And in biz, that will involve looking at what you could get from cutting the research budget. That's not to say that will happen or that's what they're seriously considering, but there'll be scenario planning for what, you know, can you cut the research budget in any way? Given there's been so much kind of concern about, although it's been ring-fenced in cash terms, a research budget for, you know, about 5 years.
Because we didn't talk about this possibly happening ahead of the last spending review, did we?
Yeah, it didn't materialise. Well, the last spending review was just a year. You know, there was a big spending review just after the last election, which kind of set budgets for a few years, and then the last one just kind of sorted out the year of the general election, so there was no kind of uncertainty there. But, yeah, there was discussion about whether the research would be cut then or money for widening participation, but of course this could crop up again, and that's all. If 25 billion is the figure that's being looked at across the government, and things like the NHS are ring fenced again, then they will have to find money in biz, and you know that increases the suggestion that research could be hit. You know, and already there's been complaints that keeping research. But the research budget ring fenced in cash terms has effectively caused a huge cut anyway because of inflation. So, you know, if you're actually going to cut it as well, then, you know, that's not good for in terms of science and research funding at all.
I mean, the other worry, of course, in all of this is who's left in biz to actually defend the research budget. There have been a lot of senior figures that have left recently. The last big spending review in 2010, David Willetts and Sir Adrian Smith got a lot of credit for what they did in terms of protecting the science budget. Both of those, of course, are no longer there.
Yeah.
The current Director General for Research and Innovation, for the first time in history, isn't a scientist, so there's also a concern there. So a lot of people are getting quite nervous about this.
And rightly so, it seems. The full story on page 8 this week. Elsewhere in the news section, there's the latest on the pensions row. And there's a UCU vote of no confidence in the University of Northampton Vice-Chancellor Nick Petford. You can find out more about that on our site as well. The latest soundbite as well from the controversial Dean of the University of Swansea's School of Management, Nigel Pearcey. I'm not sure what the context of this is. Maybe Paul can help me out here. But he said, haters gonna hate, potatoes gonna potate, but we're doing great. I'm not entirely sure what that means.
Well, I think it just means whatever the critics might allege, everything's fine here. Yes, he's been a controversial figure for quite a while. This must be at least the sixth story I've written about him in the last year. The latest salvo comes in response to a student petition, over 1,000 of them signed, in a school that only has about 1,200 students, so it's a pretty hefty proportion of them criticising the negative publicity essentially that the school's been getting, which, you know, they attribute to him. And he, in response, wrote a letter to the students, with that reference to potatoes at the end of it, essentially telling them there's nothing to worry about, everything's going in the right direction.
Sorry, could I just chip in? There is a fantastic picture of a potato to illustrate this story in the magazine this week, and I implore everyone to go out and buy a copy just to see it. It's a magnificent potato.
I don't believe it's a King Edward. I've been looking at it. I think it might be a rat. R-A-T-T-E.
Maybe that could be a Twitter competition.
Name
that variety.
H-E Spuds. I'll get on it. Hashtag. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Karen, books.
Extra pages in books this week, which always makes me happy. This week we cover Roger Scruton's book, How to Be a Conservative. Our reviewer suggests that Scruton's written this book as a sort of dialogue with his father, who was a lifelong trade unionist and socialist, but Scruton believed that his father's views bore out Robert Conquest's dictum that everyone is right-wing in the matters he knows about. Our reviewer Bill Perdue at the University of Northumbria talks about how Scruton was a hate figure amidst the socialist hegemony at Burke back in the 1980s. He also talks about how Scruton was involved in going behind the Iron Curtain before the fall of the Berlin Wall and addressing persecuted intellectuals there, which our reviewer points out perhaps the bien-pensant scholars of the time did not bother to do. Also this week, we have an important new work by Danielle Keats-Citrin, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. That's reviewed by Helen Fenwick at Durham University. It touches on the issues that obviously have been in the news a lot here with Caroline Criado Perez and Stella Creasy. And the book really focuses on cyber-based sexual harassment. Sharon Wheeler covers the marketplace of attention, how audiences take shape in a digital age. So if you can put down some of your electronic devices, you might want to read about that. Robert Galatly, the eminent historian, has covered Stephen Kotkin's landmark book, out just in time for Christmas, Stalin, Volume 1, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928. So for anybody who bought the Stalingrad book a few years ago, or any family members who like curling up with a book on a 20th century dictator, this is the one for Christmas. Nothing says Christmas like Stalin or Hitler, as anyone who follows publishing will know. David Green reviews a book called Extreme, Why Some People Thrive at the Limits. Two academics look at what we can learn from those people who live at the limits in terms of extreme climates, and how you can apply this to life in the office. And our book of the week is an amazing book. Joanna Lewis of the London School of Economics, who's an Africanist, has reviewed a book by James Smith, who is an anthropologist at the University of California, and Ngeti Mwadime, who is a Kenyan, who was his research assistant and who became his friend. The book is about email exchanges between the two of them. To be fair, we get mostly Mwadime's emails rather than Smith's. That may have to do with the perceived interest of the two. There's some eye-watering stuff. Lewis talks about the fact that, as you know, in the structural adjustment program era and the withdrawal of the development state, while arguably Africa in the digital age has never been more connected to the West, the opportunities to advance yourself are limited. So there is a sense in the book of how Mwadime's close access to the West via the internet is somewhat more illusory. Begins with probably one of the most arresting quotes from a book that we've had in a book of the week for some time. You should definitely check it out. Our reviewer said the book is fascinating, shocking, touching, disturbing, and not entirely satisfactory, and I couldn't put it down.
Fantastic. Yes, do check out this week's book section. More books this week in the form of our cover feature. Back to you, Paul, again, actually. It's all about the representations of academia in literature. You pulled this one together.
I did, yeah. Campus novels, you know, not a new subject, but we hope to get sort of a little bit beyond Kingsley Amis in this one. So we asked...
That would be good.
Yeah, so we asked five English academics, who else, to suggest their favourite book, not necessarily a campus novel, but one that in some way sort of depicted a university in some way. Quite a range of suggestions. Nabokov gets two nominations for two different books. John Sutherland went for Tom Brown at Oxford, which he describes as an appalling book, but illustrative of the power that Oxford has over English identity, which he thinks hasn't changed much in 150 years. Most recent book, a book from this year, Linda Grant, Upstairs at the Party. Emma Rees goes for that one.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. Well, let's not give them all away. We'll let people dig into those from page 34 this week. And, of course, online at timeshighereducation.co.uk. If you want to comment on anything we've been commenting on, you can do so at that web address, or you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Google+. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.